Tax Day, April 15th, 3:30, most on-time start of the year. And first bill we have up, we have Senate Bill 349, and we also have Senate Bill 263, and then House Bill 553. And I believe Mr. Heath is going to join us to talk about the APA loan budget a little later. So, Senate Bill 349, an act relating to the reorganization of private debt on the Delta Project. To testify, you want to start Frank or Dan? You guys pick.
I'll go first then.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Frank Melke from the Division of Land and Water Management, and here to testify on House Bill 349. And basically, I'll just go over the provisions of it. It does two principal things. One, it allows people to relinquish title to their land and be able to get rid of the debt, both for the clearing and for their land sale, and also allows people to lease that back with a preference right to purchase later.
Tell her we'll give her a call.
Secondly, it also allows the Agricultural Revolving Loan Fund to, or the Commissioner of Natural Resources, after consulting with the Ag Revolving Loan Fund, to write down the loans and reduce the amount of the loan. So those are the two principal provisions there. If I could go on a little further on that, basically it's a question of what to do with a lot of bad loans. And it's very similar to practices either taken or recommended in farm communities throughout the lower 48. And it's fairly consistent with that. I have an article from UPI where farm economists in the Northwest have pretty much suggested the same thing, totally independent of this proposal. So the department supports this as not anything that's really going to fix agriculture, but as a way to best salvage what investment the state has made with the minimal amount of loss to the state and expense. Basically, there's the authority to do all these things now under federal bankruptcy law. This would save a lot of people, including the state, the expenses and the time of going through bankruptcy. Everything in the bill, a bankruptcy court could order. And this just allows us to do those outside of bankruptcy.
Yeah?
When you talk about leasing this land back, to the former owner, what type of lease is that?
Take it as a percentage of the fair market value, which means we would reappraise the land at its current rate, and we're looking at a lease rate of about 2% of the fair market value for a year after looking at lease rates for farmland and other states.
What would be in Alaska?
We estimate the land, rough guess of about $150 an acre. That's agricultural rights only, so 2% of that would be about $3 an acre. Just agricultural rights only.
So if I follow this right, we're basically treating the debt on the land as non-recourse debt.
Yes, that's...
It doesn't go to the individual anyway.
No, there is a provision in the land sale contract for recourse, but this would just be... able to write that off altogether. The land typically was, particularly in the Delta II sale, was purchased for about $200 an acre, and then they borrowed about another $200 an acre to clear it. Right now we think it's worth about $150 an acre. None of this land has turned recently enough, turned over enough to have any good comparables, or any comparables at all to judge it by, so we'll have to do a new appraisal.
I guess I don't, in the legislative findings here, lines 9 through 19, I don't really see any stark revelations there that we probably didn't know when we started this program, but anything that's really come up. But section 2, I have a real question. The Commissioner of Natural Resource shall do this. Why isn't that a discretionary act with a may?
Well, I believe the fear among the farmers is that the decisions might be arbitrary, and this way it just makes everybody eligible for it. And doesn't allow the Commissioner of Natural Resources to decide which farmers will be allowed to relinquish their parcels and which won't.
What advantage does a person have not to relinquish their land if they can lease it back? Why wouldn't all of them go into it?
In Delta 1, the people didn't pay as much for the land. In fact, you could say they pretty much got the land for, I believe it was $6 an acre. So for those people, they're made, and secondly, they didn't have to borrow as much money. They borrowed, I think, $167 an acre, which they didn't. They got a real break on that because the fire came through there in 1979, and so they didn't have all the real clearing expenses. So those people are not in very deeply, and they probably would not relinquish. Many people, even in Delta 2, have a lot of reservations about giving up their land because that's what one of the things that people like about farming is you get to own a lot of land, and it gives you a good feeling that you're a big landowner and all. And this is a lot for people to give up, to say, even though it may be an albatross in terms of how much it's costing them, it's still very difficult for a farmer to give up his land. We would allow them to retain some portion of it for whatever they paid at the old purchase price, 40 to 160 acres in most cases.
What about the portion that was reserved? Didn't we give them a right to buy a fee simple portion for their house or something on this?
No, Mr. Chairman, they have the right to build buildings on an area not to exceed, it depends on the farm size, between 5 and 20 acres. That's for your barn and your house and those sort of things, but it's part of the whole parcel. It's not a separate and distinct parcel. So you don't really have fee simple rights there, but as part of your rights in owning the parcel, you can put improvements on a small portion of it.
Have any questions, Rick?
So in other words, the amount of land that would be relinquished would be up to the discretion of the commissioner, or would that be a decision that, in other words, the debt. Okay, so in other words, there's a debt load that they obviously can't pay. Therefore, if they want to relinquish 100 acres out of 160, they can give it back to the state.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Ewing, the way it's written now, it would be up to the farmer. He would say, I want to relinquish all except 40, or all except 160, or all against 640. So that would basically be up to him. He can't relinquish less than 40 because our regulations do not allow subdivision of less than 40 acres.
Okay, I guess my next question is, what are we going to do with it?
Mr. Chairman, what are we going to do with it? Believe it or not, there's people that still would like to get into farming on a smaller scale without so much debt load, and maybe if they ever are successful, they might want to expand. Secondly, there's the Department of Corrections has expressed an interest in setting up a prison farm, which I would think would be a good idea. The land's cheap anyway. There's something for them to do, and they can have a big tract. These tracts are 2,000 to 3,000 acres, some of them. So, you know, there's that. And then failing all else, there's bison habitat.
Any questions? Representative Schultz, do you have any?
No, I just support the bill as it came over. And we're primarily talking about the larger tracts of land. You're looking at the 2,000-acre tracts and things of that nature where the debt load is so high that it would allow these people to get out from underneath maybe, 500, 800, whatever acres that they felt they'd have to, and turn around and lease it back from the state if they wanted to farm it. And there are enough farmers around that would probably pick up the lease on that land if it was available, too.
Representative Cotton?
Yeah, so what happens is that if I had 100 acres and wanted to give up 50, then that 50 that I give back to the state, that comes off what I owe the state.
Excuse me?
That reduces my debt. Yes. By the amount of land I get back. And then on page 2, starting on section on line 9, this discusses not land loans, but chattel or improvements. That's a different type of ag loan?
Yes, there. You have basically three categories of debt here. One is the debt on its land with the land sale contract with the Division of Land and Water Management. Secondly is the debt that was originally administered by the old Agricultural Action Council, which is the clearing loan debt. And then you also have the Ag Revolving Loan Fund debt that's now, that has been, it's part of the Division of Agriculture. So you got three categories of debt there.
What does it mean when you say that the commissioner may renegotiate?
That means write the loan down. In other words, renegotiate the terms of the loan. In other words, saying we'll reduce the debt. Normally in bankruptcy, for instance, under Chapter 11, you reorganize. And you say, okay, I've got $1 million worth of debt. The value of my security and my collateral is $300,000. At $300,000, I can service $300,000 worth of debt. The bankruptcy court then writes the loan down to $300,000 because that's all the creditors are going to get anyway, and writes the loan down and says, and renegotiates the loan by the principal of $300,000.
So if I was a farmer and I borrowed $100 for farm improvement, so say I built a barn, is that what that would qualify for? But now it's apparent that I can't make the debt service on the loan. I can only handle $50 of it. You just forgive $50.
That's correct. Bankruptcy court can do the same thing.
So why are we doing it this way instead of requiring to go to bankruptcy?
Two reasons. Bankruptcy is very expensive. It's also very traumatic on the individuals, and it's very time-consuming. For example, one meat operation that we have up in the Mat Valley that's in bankruptcy, it's taken a year and a half. Well, we've got buildings there that as collateral. We have to keep the insurance up. Once that goes into bankruptcy, your insurance costs triple. I don't know what they did this year. They probably went up even more. So that's the kind of expense we're trying to avoid, is the additional insurance and those sort of things. And the bankruptcy court just doesn't act very quickly.
Well, but that's what I'm thinking about. The bankruptcy court, I've never been through one or observed one very closely, but I suspect that they look at it very carefully and then decide, yes, in fact, this person is in this financial situation, whereas under this, I'm just not sure what kind of examination the commissioner would require before they determined that the person could only handle half of his debt.
I can respond to that if you want, Mr. Chairman. Basically, what we would look at is, you know, how much is it going to cost us to foreclose and maintain the collateral? What are our bankruptcy expenses? And the first thing that comes off of everything in bankruptcy is the expenses of administration, which means attorney's fees and other things come right off the top. We'd look at the value of the collateral. If we were extremely well collateralized, I don't know why we would write the loan down. If we were in a position to go and foreclose and get it, we likely would. But the situation being that many of these loans, particularly the clearing loans, had no collateral other than the land, and the land has got already more debt against it than it's worth, so it's not really collateral. Would look at the, how hard it would be to get a deficiency judgment out of the person. Would look at, what kind of cash flow, what kind of market there were, and those kind of economic factors. Would also look at the borrower herself and himself and see if the borrower had the ability to reorganize in the management, farming, and other experience to actually run a successful operation, and then the time that it would take to do all this.
You feel like you'd have the ability to look into the person's back pocket as easily or as efficiently as a bankruptcy court would?
Yes. If we don't, we can always go to court and through discovery get any of that.
Representative Fuller, you had a
question. Are there any farmers that are successful in the state?
Oh yes, there are. Yes. Let me be real frank though. In Delta, right now I'd say there's only a few of them that are breaking even on their operating expenses. As far as servicing their past debt and essentially approximately $1 million per farmer, no. I don't think anybody's that good. But there are people, particularly in Delta, growing barley that, you know, can make their operating expenses and can show a small profit. Even where the price is as low as it is, now. This is a low time in the price, overall world prices of grain. So there's a few people that are successful, yes.
Do you have any projection on how many, how many people are involved, will be involved in this if it was passed, this bill is passed?
No more than 37, because this only applies to 37 farmers, the Delta 1 and Delta 2 land disposals. But it affects many more people than that, other borrowers. And
what's the total debt outstanding?
My estimate's $29 million. I haven't updated that. That's the total debt, land debt, clearing loan debt, farm loan debt.
Could I just add something, add something here? On the farmers that that we're talking about in the big tracts in the Delta 1 and Delta 2, the state had some other disposals in there that were 80-acre parcels and 40-acre parcels for farming purposes. All of those are, to my knowledge, just about every single solitary one of them are free and clear. The people own them. The farmers that are successful in the Delta area are farmers that have been there for, well, you take Dennis Green, for example. He has several thousand acres, and his land, 90% of it or so, is all fee simple title land. I mean, he owns it. And it's taken accumulation of years before him, and he can use that land for collateral and so on and so forth. So, but Dennis has been successful, and the farmers that have owned the land, fee simple title. It's when we got into this whole thing and trying to structure this ag rights only is when we started, you know, with our innovative programs and things that we began creating some of the problems that we have today.
Well, I guess, you know, I understand the need to get some flexibility to manage some debt or something like that, but I don't see it much different than with AHSC when the next couple of years we AHSC owns a couple thousand homes on the market and going to come in for the power to renegotiate all of those down so that people can keep them. Same argument, if we don't do it, we're going to end up a bunch of empty houses on our hands.
They have mortgage insurance.
They have mortgage insurance that pays off almost all of that, unless the price drops way down. But now we have our fishing boat loans over here on the other side, and I can see a bill from the Department of Commerce to do this with them. So that's why I'm just trying to get into the difference in here between the mandatory and the discretionary, because the mandatory says everybody up there, all 37 of them, can do this regardless of their financial condition. You know, regardless of whether they're on the step of bankruptcy or not.
And, now, the shall, though, only applies to relinquishment. The write-down of the loan is still discretionary. They're two separate.
Well, if you relinquish the land, you're relinquishing the debt with the land, right?
Yes, or else you wouldn't relinquish it. You'd keep it.
So that's a kind of a write-down?
In effect, yes, it is, but they're giving up the property at the same time.
Representative Ewing?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Had you ever looked into the fact of just giving the land away? In other words, let's not administer any new loans and parcel it out to new people and let people subdivide it or do whatever they want and sell it to other people for whatever purpose and stimulate the economy that way, so that, you know, we wouldn't have to keep administering new loan programs and more money out there to new groups. And
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ewing, are you speaking of just giving away everything other than ag rights, or just?
I mean, just all the land itself. In other words, if we've got under the ag revolving loan fund, okay, if we've got, you know, loans in there for the chattel or for the house and for the barn and for the barn and for the all the other things that go along with it, fine. Maybe that'll improve our default rate on some of those other things that we've lent out, and we'll continue with that. But let them have the land, you know, and let them use it the way they please.
That's basically what happened in Delta 1. It was $6 an acre, which is essentially giving it away. In Delta 2, though, don't ask me exactly how this happened, but the decision was made to go with an auction, and that was supported in the community because that way, by God, if someone wanted that parcel, he could bid high enough to get it. And they wanted it, and now they've changed their mind, most of them.
Okay. I guess what would be, in other words, okay, we're gonna get those people off the hook, those 37 people, and okay, they give it back to you, but you'll have to administer it again and go through the same procedure and make, you know, I just don't think the state has, if we could just let the private people take care of it, we might be better off.
Well, without this bill, wouldn't it go through? The people who have to would end up going through bankruptcy, and the property would eventually come out on the market, and it would be in the private sector again. I guess that's...
It'd be in the private sector again?
Yeah.
Well, they put it up for sale.
They put it up for sale. Bankruptcy judge put it up for sale.
Mr. Chairman, what we would probably do is go into a leasing program, because if someone simply wants to farm, leasing is a much better way to go. Now, right now, I don't think people are able to borrow money anyway, anywhere else except the Ag Loan Fund. And the argument is usually made, and normally in most cases would work out, that if you had the title to it, you could borrow against it, you wouldn't need it. But people trying to borrow against ag rights land have not been very successful. And so this way, if someone wants to farm, we would really be better off leasing, because the state's been the banker anyway.
How do we make any money leasing, though?
Excuse me?
How do we make any money leasing? the amount that you described that it would cost, I don't see how you could make administrative costs in it.
We would probably do good to break even. We get a few dollars an acre for it a year, which is more than we're getting now, because people aren't making their payments. I mean, right now people aren't, there's a moratorium and they're not making their land payments. They don't like that either, because the interest is piling up on it and their debt load is getting bigger every year. And it's pretty discouraging for someone to start out that deeply in debt and then go that much more in debt every year.
Did we pass that production credit bill against interest? Where's that at?
Senate Finance.
That's sponsored by the same people for this, isn't it?
Mr. Chairman, I guess my last point would be that, you know, we've given, you know, since I've been in the legislature, just the 4 years I've been in, every year we have a new bill that comes out where we're trying to help them and we're trying to give them a moratorium on payments, and now we're just going to end up, you know, giving it back to them, letting them give up their responsibility anyway, so why not just let them have it anyway? I mean, and grant it to them. And then the other loans that we have, like the accessory kind of things that go all with it, maybe they'd make their payments on that, and that would improve the defaults in that area. I'll ask the key sponsor.
If I may, it's not such a bad idea. You got that same kind of program in effect right now. We've got approximately in the vicinity of 15,000 acres that's going on the block this year, and it's a giveaway. And that is a giveaway that you simply go out. In some cases, the state's already surveyed it. In some instances, the state is not. You go out, you pound the stakes. You go out, you clear the land, do whatever. You can farm it. You can do whatever. Build a cabin, live off out there. And it's the old homestead bill, you know. So, right. And so we have a program like that. It's too bad that we didn't incorporate a comparable type of program. Fee simple title, et cetera. That's what this land will be with the homesteads, with the agricultural community. I think it would have been a lot more successful than it is today, because the people wouldn't have had the overhead, et cetera, that they've got, the debt burden that they have, you know, with in the auction. And some of these places they bid up. I don't know, what was the most they bid up? Maybe
The town now loop auction, some of those got bid as high as 750, the smaller parcels, 750 an acre, but the big parcels still got bid up to, I think the highest is about $220 an acre, which was you would have had to been there at the time. There were so many promises made about how good this was that everybody just went crazy on it.
Yeah. And the one across the Gersel, there were 6,000 acres that was in the vicinity of $200 an acre.
If
it's a million
I could,
some odd bucks.
Mr. Chairman, if I could respond to Representative Ewling's suggestion there. I imagine we would dispose of some of this land under the homestead program if in smaller parcels. So I think that was the key thing here. The argument had gone back and forth whether people, this is back in the late 70s, whether you should give farmers a lot of land. Because you said, well, farming is marginal, so you got to give them a lot of land so they can make any money. Or else whether you should start small and then grow. And the argument came out, at least in state policy, that we would give them a lot of land. And what we did was gave them a lot of land to go very deeply in debt in, is the net result. And if it's a smaller parcel, people don't go into debt so deeply and they can service that debt themselves from off-farm income or whatever and have some time to generate some other income. But secondly, there's also a philosophy that the general rule is when you alienate something from the public domain, there should be some return to that. The homestead program is an exception to that, but not a complete exception, because a lot of people won't decide to live there, will decide to exercise their purchase option, so that even under that program, there will be some return to the state. So that's basically been a legislative policy that's been enacted in Title 38, that the general rule is fair market value. And, you know, fair market value as we know today is something people could service the debt on. But fair market value, as it was hyped up back in the early 80s, back when this auction was, in fact, I was the auctioneer there at Delta 2, was fair market value then was $200 an acre. People had confidence the state would continue to keep putting money into the project, so it seemed like a good deal to get into. But people weren't necessarily buying the land. They were buying into the loan eligibility and all the other assistance that comes along with that. So it's not really fair to say that was the value of the land at that time, because the package is much bigger.
Sam, and then we have Dan. Do you want to comment, too? Or?
I just have a couple comments.
Okay.
Just real quick. If you're going to lease a portion of the land or all the land for a term of 20 years at full fair market value, how does that work? Suppose I'm going to lease that 50 acres now from you for 20 years at full fair market value, and you value the land at, say, $150. So I've got 50 acres, that's $750.
Well, we would use a percent of that each year. That's normally the way you do lease appraisals. You appraise the full fee value, and then you say it's a percentage of that.
What's the percent? How do you? The bill doesn't discuss really what.
No, it would be the fair market value of the leasehold or of the lease, not the fair market value of the full title, but only the fair market value of the lease. And the figures I'm giving you are rough. I'm just saying that
What if it was 100 acres? What would you suggest that a person would have to pay per year?
I would say about $3 an acre is what the fair market value is. And to compare with what we've got today, we're getting nothing off of it. $3 an acre is, you know, $3 better than nothing.
That's comparable to
what I was just scratching my head.
But if I may, but that's the state's leasing out land today for that.
Mr. Chairman, it costs the Prime Minister the program than it costs to lease it, probably. I mean, we're probably spent. How many people does it take to do this?
It costs more than three.
It'll take one person probably to appraise it, to execute the leases, but they're a 20-year lease. So then it'll take somebody to take the money in. But remember, these are going to be fairly large parcels. And we have payments as small as $50 a year on some parcels, and it's still cost-effective to do that.
Any other questions, sir? We need to...
I'd just like to say I also have Hal Ward here, who is the manager of the Ag-Revolving Loan Fund, if you have any questions about how the loan fund operated.
We have a question how you figure out what's a default and a delinquency, but we'll go into that.
You want an answer to that? Or?
I already know the answer.
Okay, thank you.
Dan, did you want to make a comment? I understand you've hired a banker, so maybe that theory will change.
Mr. Chairman, my name's Dan Beck, and I'm from Senator Coghill's office. I just wanted to make a couple comments and ask for any questions if there were any additional questions. A couple of the reasons for putting the bill in: one was to stabilize the ag project and minimize the state loss. The second was to hopefully put farmers on their own, put them in a situation where they could service their debt load to the state. There was one question that came up earlier about the section on the relinquishment having shall in there rather than may. And one reason that should be in there, it puts a determination of back in the farmer's hand of how much or how large of a parcel they could handle. And there are a few solvent farmers up there, as mentioned before. Right now, the feeling seems to be that a parcel somewhere around 600 to 1,000 acres is feasible for making a living. That's all I've got.
Any questions, Dan? Anybody else here want to testify on Farm Bill? Can we make a few comments? Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I'd
My name is Hal Ward. I'm with the Agricultural Revolving Loan Fund. I just would like to make a couple of comments about the second page, Section 9, in terms of the renegotiating of the loans. We don't have any firm numbers there. It would all have to be based on any kind of renegotiation would have to be based individually on an income approach based on the kinds of crops that individual's producing, what equipment he has out there, the type and structure of buildings that we're involved with, and the use of those buildings over term. The Ag Revolving Loan Board would have to look at each one of those cases individually and say, well, what kind of debt service do we have out here? What's the capacity of the borrower based on the amount of land he has now and the income approach, and arrive at some numbers on that basis. And to lay out terms and conditions at this point would be nearly impossible. We'd have to just look at it, you know, if the bill's accepted and approved. Do a workout. Basically provides us with
the interest rate is set at 8%.
Interest rate right now is at 8%.
Could you renegotiate the interest rate in this bill?
I would assume we would. Right now, Fed comp on a national indicator is 7.98%, which is the amount of income that one can receive on time CDs over 100,000 on the New York market. Prime is at 9. We'd look at some kind of a market indicator, I assume, to decide what kind of rate. Right now, of course, rates are low. Nationally, and that probably will decline a little more before they start up.
I thought we had this interest rate set by statute.
I think it is.
So you're saying that this word in here, may renegotiate, opens up not only the terms, the capacity loan, but the interest rate also?
Well, it may or may not. If you change this statute, how broad is that renegotiate term, you know, how far does that extend in terms of terms and conditions, or does it also include rate? A lot of times you can lengthen out the rate of the loan, the term of the loan, change the conditions of the loan to allow for maybe a 40-year amortization, but a 10-year payout, those kinds of things can be modified to allow for reasonable debt service to see if he's really going to be able to make it. If you can't make it, then you have to have some point in time when you say this will not work under any conditions for this borrower and we'll have to look for somebody else.
Any questions? What does renegotiate mean to you since it's in this bill?
It would mean to renegotiate the basic terms and conditions of the loan to include the length of repayment, the kinds of collateral that we have available, the documentation that we have on that collateral to strengthen our position in terms of documentation for security agreements and financing statements.
Any questions of the committee? Anybody? What do you want to make? I want to move the bill. Every one of us gets to see it except for Mr. Fuller one more time. I see it in resources, and you guys see it in finance. So.
Just one real quick question. What about the people that aren't in trouble? They're still paying 8% on their chattel loans. The people that do get in trouble, you're going to let them go down to 6 or whatever. Mm-hmm. Is that fair?
I don't think so. No, and I don't know that we'd let them go down any in rate. I think what we'd look at is to change the terms of repayment so that it's lengthened out. Now, the individual that's not in trouble on his loan is going to be able to service his debt in an orderly manner and pay off the loan, hopefully, over time and not have to worry about loan payments 6 years down the road or 5 years down the road. If he's 2 years into a chattel loan now and he can pay it out in 5, why would he want to renegotiate a 40-year amortization on that loan and add more years down the road and then have to buy more equipment to replace and those kinds of things? It wouldn't make sense.
I'll move the bill, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, motion to move committee substitute for Senate Bill 349, Finance with Individual Recommendations. See any objection? Hearing none, bill moves to resources. The next bill we had was 263, but somebody has to go give Representative Fakes. Bob, you want to give us your wisdom while we wait for the senator to show up?
That's where I can, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Heath has agreed to come show up today. We had some questions on the APA loans budget yesterday, and I think everybody had a folder or something on it, but there was two items in there in the proposed budget a $6 million item and a $400,000 item for regional electrification. Bob, maybe you could just tell us what's happening there, what the issue is.
Mr. Chairman, we have a power project loan request as well as a rural electrification revolving loan fund request in. And basically each are backed by requests of communities and or legislators. I confess to one small thing. I left my glasses in the hotel and I can't read the darn stuff.
Can I just ask a general question?
Sure. Representative Cotton.
So, let's see, interest maybe not less than 5 or more than market rate. And then you've got a list here from Antioch on down to Thorne Bay. Is that list supposed to total $6 million?
Should be very close, Representative Cotton.
I don't really have a lot. Then the other one was you had $400,000 requested by the governor for the rural electrification revolving loan fund, and then you had quite a bit more than $400,000 worth of requests. For instance, the non-Dalton Keys Point line extension project shows $600,000 FY86, $600,000 FY87. Did they get $600,000 last year at 2%?
At this point, they have nothing, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, so the FY86 numbers there don't necessarily mean that money was dispersed in 86.
There is a loan request in from non-Dalton, and it has not been approved. The board hasn't even seen it at this point in time.
So do you have, how much money do you have in the revolving loan fund now? Is that something we had on our list? Mm-hmm.
Being totally unprepared for this hearing. Huh? Talking about being totally unprepared for this hearing.
Yeah.
I just felt like I had some general questions. Rural electrification. What's left in there then? How much is in that fund right now?
Let me use your pen too, if I may.
Yeah.
Thank you.
No. Only if the electric goes through all the things. That's my understanding. I've been having a hard time reading this one sheet. It says rural electrification. The governor's request was $400,000. And then it says estimated loan volume would be $4.2 million. So does that mean that there's $4.2 million in the rural electrification revolving loan fund?
Yes. At one time, Representative Cotton, there was a plan that has many plans have changed, as you're well aware in this session. There was a plan to transfer some excess funds from the original power cost assistance program into that loans budget. Precisely where that is right now, I couldn't answer you.
Whether you can give it to me now or not, I'd like to know how much is in the rural electrification revolving loan fund. Expected FY86 year end balance. That'd be good. And then we've got the request for $400,000. I understand that, but I didn't understand how much was actually in that fund.
Why don't you make a note and ask Bush for that?
Does anybody know? Okay. You can get that for me, I assume, though.
Okay. Well, the best I can tell is $4.2
million. Well, that's what it looks like, because it says, that's the column, it says loan volume under governor's budget. So if there is $4.2 million in there, then most of those items, including those recreational areas and line extensions inside municipalities and so forth, could get funded.
Yeah.
At 2%. Some of them are in the rail bill. You know, they ought to come out of the rail bill fund. More on that later.
More on that later, yes. Okay, we'll get an answer to that question, Representative Cotton. The other item, I guess, Bob, I had was, it looks like in the governor's loan budget, there's $4 million proposed to be reappropriated out of the Power Development Revolving Loan Fund, and I presume that's the four-dam pool loan fund in Commerce.
Mr. Chairman, that is basically some excess that is in there. We have held back in that fund roughly $1.5 million to cover costs and a $7 million retention. It's merely a self-insurance retention. Our deductible on Terra Lake is $7 million. So if something happened to Terra Lake and the legislature were not in session, we'd be unable to fix it, or any other dams for that matter. I mean, it could be a smaller amount. But
so that's the $7 they keep, and then the other $4 is the overage?
Apparently that's the way it's reading. So you have the $7 plus another $1.5 million, is that what you said, for
yes,
finishing up things?
And the $4 million was to be transferred. Part of that, of course, comes from the payments from the four dam pool communities, yeah, anticipated to be received in FY 87.
Yeah. Okay. Any other questions, Bob? We've been asked to come back with our proposed loans budget by Friday here, so we're just the last items in what is the governor's proposed budget that we've been working on, and that was the last two items we had, was the $6 million in the power project fund and the rural electrification fund, and we'll get the rest of that together.
With your permission, Mr. Chairman, I would furnish the backup we have for these loans, requesting the communities from legislators and others to your...
Appreciate it very much, yeah. Maybe, John, you could get that. Yeah. Okay. That ends the testimony on the loans budget carryover from yesterday.
Is this another Senate bill we're going
to do? Yeah, we're moving today. Senate Bill 263. Senator Fakes is here to... Would you care to join us? We're kind of informal on this side of the aisle.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
It's a 9-page bill. Okay. We could... I see what the... Okay. Why don't you go ahead and explain the bill to us?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Jan Fakes. I represent South Anchorage, Midtown, in the state Senate. Mr. Chairman, what we were trying to do is, in this state, we have almost 8,000 delinquent child support payments owing the children of Alaska over $30 million. There has to be a way to encourage both the mother and the father, to whoever is assigned by the courts, to pay their child support payments. A year ago, October, the Child Support Enforcement Division issued a report that shows that approximately 80% of the clients in AFDC have child support payments due them and are receiving child support payments. So there is a link, a direct link, between child support payments and welfare payments, AFDC, the various programs that we have. What this bill is doing, with the support of the Child Support Enforcement Division, is disqualifying anyone in the state of Alaska from receiving a loan if they are delinquent on their child support payments. Now, we didn't know how this was going to work until AHFC adopted a regulation and began doing this program. And it really it's too early to tell really the impact, but it's about 5% of their loans to date. People are coming in and they quickly, it's all computerized. AHFC calls on the phone. The Child Support Enforcement Division finds out if this person is on the delinquent list. Immediate information is telegraphed, and in every case, the person has paid up sometimes as much as $10,000 to the child that the money is due in order to get their AFDC. I feel that if someone owes their child child support payment, if they won't pay their child the obligation that the court has ordered, then why are they going to pay back a state loan? And so the only argument or the only debate that I've ever heard on this bill is the debate on the student loan. They said, well, you're keeping a person from bettering themselves so they can make the child support payment. Well, I say hogwash to that. If they aren't willing to pay the money due their child, then they aren't going to pay the money due their the state. To me, they're a poor risk for any kind of state loan as well as a student loan, because their payback record is not very good. So basically, that's the bill. It would prohibit anyone who has a court order obligation that they are delinquent on in the state system from getting a state loan until that obligation is cleared up.
Okay, just a couple of questions. Going through the bill, maybe you could point out the loan programs that this covers.
Yes, sir. I have a sectional. I apologize if you didn't receive that sectional. Section 1 is the Ag Loan Program. Sections 2 and 3 are the Student Loan Program. Section 4 is the Commercial Fishing Loan Program.
You've got that list.
Oh, okay. Great. Thank you.
I can get that far. Maybe we should amend the Ag Loan Program so they can't renegotiate the loan leases either. We just did ag loan bills.
You would not hear any complaint from me.
You didn't leave any loan programs out?
No, sir.
What about the historic preservation loan?
I don't think there's any money in that.
Oh, yeah.
Well, there's more.
Oh, yeah. There's
more. Oh, well.
That's resurrected itself.
Put it in.
Well, it's just
kind of... You can't just make it apply to all commerce anytime.
No, because some of them, like, I don't know, even putting a bulk fuel loan program, I'm not sure it really fits there, but...
Yeah, you don't set those into a person anyway. You can...
got the child care historical district.
Teacher scholarship.
She's got that.
Commercial fishing, child care, power project, alternative technology.
Alternative energy.
Got it.
Okay, and residential. It looks like it's just child care and historical district.
Okay, sir.
And how the HAD program over in CNRA, is that?
The rural housing loans?
We would, housing assistant loan program, that's it, isn't it? Isn't that HAD?
Yes.
Okay, that's section 8.
Section 8, okay.
So she's got them covered.
Okay, any questions, Rick?
Nope.
Sam? Jack, any questions?
Very good.
Yes, move the bill.
This bill goes straight to finance, so. Anybody else want to testify on this bill? I would note, just for the record, it doesn't. The process from HFC isn't really automatic. You got to fill out a form at your bank, and then the bank sends it to Child Support in Anchorage, and then they send it back to the bank, and then the bank puts it in the loan package and sends it to HFC. And it works real well in Anchorage. But let me tell you, from Ketchikan, it's a different ballgame.
Holly says she would take phone calls, is what Ms. Plug said. She said they have taken phone calls, and they will take phone calls and then verify it and then follow it up with a note to the file.
Yeah, it's just been
A little cumbersome
sometimes.
Okay. Well, she really wants to make this work, so I would suggest that if you have a particular problem like that, she'll bend over backwards to make this work.
It wasn't so much coming from Holly, it was coming from HFC, that if the exact proper document signed, sealed, and delivered didn't arrive with the loan package, they reject the entire loan package and send it back to the bank, and then make you go through all the hoops. And in Anchorage, it works well because you can run down
carry
and hand carry it around, but outside it. I think they finally worked a lot of the bugs out.
Okay, good. It's not meant to be another onerous thing. It just really is meant to get that $30 million back to the children, if at all possible.
Okay, any other questions? Nothing else?
I'll move it, Mr. Chairman.
There's a motion to move House Committee Substitute for House Committee. This was done.
Yes.
Senate Bill 263 with individual recommendations. Any objections? None. The bill moves
to... Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members of the committee.
House Finance. Okay, moving along, House Bill 553. Thought we got rid of this last Friday, but Representative Ewing and Jeff, you're here to testify on this. Why don't you join us?
You want me to start and then we'll...
Well, you can start from there if you want. We're kind of informed. You can join us at the table there, Jeff, and then we'll...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is...
So you wanted to say something, Jeff?
Did you
have... Representative Gall is here also.
Oh, he's got this. Yeah.
For the record, my name is Representative Rick Ewing, representing downtown Anchorage. The bill before you, House Bill 553, an act making special appropriations to the Department of Community and Regional Affairs for senior citizen housing development grants and for low-cost and low-income housing development and providing for an effective date is before you. Basically, you should have in your packet a information packet on 553. It was written. It appropriates $21,963,000 to the Department of Community and Regional Affairs for the development of seniors housing projects throughout the state, as you can see, and $3 million for the development of low-cost and low-income housing. In developing the list of projects to be included in the legislation for senior housing, all projects for which applications were received by CRA were included. The intent was to try to show that there was a need for senior housing throughout the state, not just for Anchorage, so it was an omnibus bill of a lot of different areas in the state, all combined and put into one bill. Under the section regarding the low-income and low-cost housing, the amount of $3 million was simply chosen. The program has never received a great deal of funding since its inception and is out of money now. However, I do have to note that when I was chairman of the Special Committee on State Loans, I believe in 1983, there was an approximate $3 million, I believe, that was put in there for that program to pass the houses. And I think it might have been moved downward from the $3 million. Was it, Dave? I can't remember. Vetoed completely? All of it? I thought we had $1 million left in there. These are the big pieces of the day, maybe millions of dollars. But it is obvious under the current revenue situation, the outlook for the funding of these two programs at the levels proposed in the legislation is not probable. There are two ways the Loans Committee could attempt to reduce the amount of appropriation. First, with regard to senior housing, the committee could choose with projects to fund and include them in the bill. Or second, the Loans Committee could take a dollar amount and appropriate it, letting the Department of Community and Regional Affairs decide who should receive the funding. I have included a draft committee substitute, which does take the second approach. In the draft committee substitute, $7 million is appropriated to the Department for senior housing and about $1.5 million for low-income, low-cost housing. The department has a grant review committee which reviews the grant applications and awards the grants. The department is familiar with the applications and the applicants and would be in the best situation to decide who or who should not receive the funding. And this, of course, would be a preferable approach. So we have come down and scaled that down. I understand maybe this is an amount of money that's in the spending plan. However, there is a constituency out there of people who are very interested in this, and there's a waiting list on some of these senior projects, all the way from Haines to Fairbanks to the intermediate care facility at Cook Inlet Housing Authority in Anchorage, and some other projects. And I can answer questions on specifics.
Okay. No, Representative Gall, you want to just join us up here, and then we're all at one table here. I think all the mics are on, maybe.
And likewise, she doesn't trust the university.
Did you have a few comments you wanted to make on this issue, or
on any sort of subject?
We're not telecom. No.
This is not my chance to get on the
air. No,
I'm sorry. Only a few comments, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
First of all, I'd like to put on the record my strong support for the legislation. I was honored that Representative Ewling approached me with the bill as he was developing it and gave me an opportunity to join him. The essential need for the bill is fairly straightforward and probably well known to the members of this committee. We have gone into the planning. I guess in a way what's really a shame is that Mr. Joe Wilson, who is here to testify, had to leave because Joe had provided me with about a 5-inch thick pile of plan and design documents indicating that several of the projects that had been noted here, Clinkett and Haida and Cake and Haines and others, are ready to go to bid. And a lot of money and time and expectations have been developed, and obviously the construction funds are not there. So originally, I supported the original bill as written with some possible additions, and facing up to the realities of the budget, it would be my hope that we could turn a bill out of this committee that would, how shall I say it, provide what monies we think we can fight for the program. If my district or yours or the sponsors are funded, well and good, but I think we've got to look to the needs of the seniors around the state and recognize that if we provide some of these facilities, there is a cost benefit to the state in terms of integrating residential, medical, transportation, and nutrition programs in a way to keep people out of institutions. It's got a proven track record. Although it is certainly front-loading the process, there's no question in my mind I'd be happy to provide statistical support to demonstrate the long-term cost benefits to the state.
Representative Cotton.
Well, how would you prioritize this in regard to, or in relation to, say, the Metlakatla Annan Island Elementary Addition Phase 2? Assuming that, that anything like this would be regarded as a capital budget item.
Well, if the money for this comes out of the capital budget.
I don't know. Maybe I'm reading this wrong. This would be capital appropriation.
Well, but it's a special appropriation.
Maybe, Jeff, if I follow this right, you have an existing program in the department. Is that correct?
Right. For both the programs discussed in this, we have a senior citizen housing development program and a low-income housing development program.
But these are capital funds. These aren't operating or loans or anything, right?
No, they have traditionally been appropriated in the capital budget.
Well,
that it was a capital appropriation.
I would have to respond this way. Number one, I would hope to see this as an addition to the capital budget, not as a substitution for other projects. Number two, I recognize the difficulties in doing that, but notwithstanding those difficulties, think that senior housing is a basic and appropriate kind of a thing, and that it warrants that sort of an increase. If money has to come out of the existing capital budget in order to implement the bill, I would be willing to speculate there might be some political ramifications to that.
Well, there's $300 million in the capital budget right now.
Well, when you put it that way, let's take it out of some of that extra million.
I think the way the original bill was proposed, it has very specific items, and you can see what election district they all go into. The CS is more of a statewide approach, and it would be a statewide concept.
Well, I have no objection to a competitive approach for these funds. I obviously would like to list all the projects in my district, but notwithstanding what I'd wish, if we can get some money into senior housing by any means at all, that would be a good thing to do. And certainly I would trust the department to come up with a competitive system that's not prejudiced.
I guess we can't ask Jeff to sit through an hour and a half hour meeting without saying something. So.
Well,
do you have any comments for us here?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Without commenting on the aspect of how the funding is going to come together for the loans, capital, and operating budget, I'll just limit my comments to the bill. I am just listening to Representative Yulin explain his sponsor substitute. We would be in favor of that. I think it speaks very directly to our position paper that we submitted to you on the issue. We think we have a fair, well-developed process to appropriate funds out of those two funds for specific projects. We do ensure that a feasibility analysis is done, that it goes through a objective review process, and the funds are awarded that way. So in the terms of $7 million to the senior citizens and $1.5 million to the low income, there's no question in our mind that there are quality projects out there that are in much need of being funded and implemented. Just as an example, I was up in Palmer for the governor last year on a number of issues. Probably 30% of the comments that I received up there were on senior citizen housing and the needs in the Palmer area. So there are other areas, as the original bill demonstrates, that there are projects that are desired. The sponsor substitute would ensure that there is some kind of evaluation and feasibility analysis done for those. The low-income housing project was really basically only funded one time. We were able to get some projects out of that money. We have a project in Kodiak, Eagle River, and Fairbanks. However, Anchorage is still desired a project, and there are other low-income housing units being looked at by the different communities. So without commenting on how all the funding needs are going to come together based on the revenues, we think that there is some justification for these figures laid out in the sponsor substitute, and we think the process is a good one because of its objectivity in awarding to the funds based on the best project and not necessarily based on the ability to put it in the political capital budget as
Mr.
a designated.
Representative Gall.
Thank you. Just two questions. One is, this $1.5 million for low income, what do you think the public policy impact would be of kicking that up into the 7 and just dealing with senior housing in this bill? On the assumption that the money came through.
$1.5 million, to be perfectly honest, is going to buy you maybe one project.
I guess I would just suggest not that the committee take the action, but at least consider just dealing with senior housing in the bill. I'm not, again, strongly I'd like to say I'm not recommending that you do that, just that, that you look at the issue and think about it, because it may, I don't know if you see any future for the bill, frankly, but if you do, I think there's something to be said for that. Secondly, and this is just a comment, or maybe I should do it as a question, Jeff, the Older Persons Action Group suggested to me, and I think to the sponsor as well, that we try to focus on the projects ready to go to bid. And I was wondering whether by further narrowing the field that way, that might be useful to indicate whatever the figure is, and that it be for this particular type of project and be used only for construction projects that have got all their other work done by such and such a date or something of that sort.
We currently have, Mr. Chairman, approved projects that have been through the planning process totaling $8 million that I think would meet Representative Gall's criteria.
Nome, Jeff. Excuse me, Jeff. From Nome.
Huh?
From Nome. It all comes from Nome.
Goldfields and
gold is down, man.
I think it's a great program. I know our community's taken advantage of the program, and Community of Regional Affairs has done a good job in getting some senior housing out in Eagle River. And I remember the one year we did put some money into the program, but even though it was a generic appropriation like this, we all ran around and made deals with the commissioner at that time to make sure that, you know, the projects that were going to happen, we knew which ones were going to get funded beforehand. So we felt very big-hearted about throwing it into a fund here that wasn't, didn't have our district's name on it. But
must have been a previous commissioner.
I think that people that are interested in senior housing ought to be, it's my personal opinion, is that they ought to be looking at a capital budget situation. But I think that's a good idea.
How many projects could we fund with the $7 million that are bid ready?
I believe there are four that have gone through the planning process. And
which are they?
I do not know. I know Anchorage is one of them. I believe the Palmer facility may be another one. And I think Haynes might be the third, but I can get back to the committee on what those specific projects are and what their individual funding requirements
are. might be able to take care of Anchorage and Haynes.
Yeah. I guess my feeling, I apologize to Representative Gilling for not getting this bill up last week, but Peter, if you're interested in working on this, I just soon move the bill. It goes to your committee.
Go to finance or to
me? It looks like CNR.
Well, it has to go to finance.
CNRA and then finance.
Sam,
next to committee in there,
30
so.
30 pounds and a lot of problems, my friend. So just don't sit
up. Get out the fiddles.
No, I'm not kidding. I
get something to adopt this CSR.
I'm moving to adopt it.
Yeah, there's a motion to adopt the committee substitute for House Bill 553 loans. No objection, that's adopted. You want to move the bill?
Yeah, I'll move the bill.
Okay. There's a motion to move the committee substitute for House Bill 553 loans with individual recommendations, and it goes to the CNRA committee.
Get it right up. Why don't you come by and meet with me, and we'll figure out what we're going to do.
We're adjourned.
Yeah, we can do it now if you want. We can do it here now.
Did I get that stuff from John? Did we get stuff from Jeff on the...